just was in Israel this past week, and I really must say it was a fantastic experience. We are located, our yeshiva is located in a yeshuv, that's a settlement, which is about 10 miles out of the outskirts of Jerusalem, in the northeast. And about a 10-15 minute ride by car. They have a new road there, so it's very safe. You don't get any villages. And from the settlement, you can see French Hill, which is part of Jerusalem. They kept on asking, you know, everybody's trying to figure out how far it is. By my hiking experience, well, the location is really excellent. It's an excellent learning location. You know, the Talmud states that the yeshivas were always outside of the cities because the yeshiva, you want to have a place that's conducive for contemplation and thinking and learning, and therefore outside the city is really the best place. And yet Jerusalem is visible from the settlement. As a matter of fact, they want to give us land. I just spoke to my brother this morning, and the settlement wants to give the yeshiva land. We have a choice of two mountains. Each one is approximately seven to ten acres of land. And all we have to do is really build a road there and connect it to the yeshuv, which would cost about $6,500, and then we could make a claim for the land and register the land as ours, because we are in the liberated territories. We're over the line, but we're really within eyesight of Jerusalem. So it depends what the government is going to do, but if the government does decide to not to give this land back to the Arabs, then we're in an ideal location. Couldn't be better, because this would be like a suburb right outside of Jerusalem. The last suburb, which is 10 miles away, is called Pisgat Zev. And as I said, we're northeast of Jerusalem itself. So the location was excellent, and I really enjoyed it. The first time I've been there in 2 years, and actually I've never seen this part of our yeshiva, because last time I was there was 2 years ago. We were located in Jerusalem, and this is just the last 2 years that we have this location. It's working out very well, and the settlement is extremely happy with the yeshiva. It's really a symbiotic relationship and mutually beneficial. So I enjoyed very much being there, and I was busy there for a week. I was busy the entire time with the students, giving classes and discussing ideas. And our yeshiva really has, I would say it's about 50-50, 50% Americans and 50% Israelis. And the Americans, a lot of them I'm familiar with, if, you know, they're from our yeshiva or high schools, and I am familiar with them. But the first time I had the opportunity to meet the Israelis, and I really was impressed with them. Because of their sincerity and also their desire to understand the ideas and the philosophy of Judaism. You have to know that in the religious community today in Israel, it is pretty much dichotomized. In other words, you have the extremely religious groups, and then you have the groups that are irreligious. And the groups that are religious are not really into the vast amount of knowledge that we have in from our scholars on philosophy. They sort of shun philosophy, and anyone that asks any questions is simply condemned because, you know, you're not allowed to ask questions, that type of approach. But these Israelis come from that background. And I was really amazed at the tremendous interest they showed in the desire to discuss philosophical points of Judaism, which their situation had never been exposed to. We discussed many different topics. A couple of the students asked me for a private session because they are in the army, and they're confronted constantly by the what's called the chilonim, which means the group that are non-religious, hasn't been exposed to any kind of philosophy, and they come from religious backgrounds where you study Talmud, the legalistic part of Talmud, but you never study the philosophy. So it was an extremely rewarding experience for me to have the opportunity to answer the need that is was expressed by these students. In terms of the desire for an understanding of philosophy, I was completely busy with the yeshiva there. As a matter of fact, I never even got a chance to get down to see the Kotel, the wall, or really the old city of Jerusalem at all. But I felt that my time was really spent in a more meaningful way, really in the study of Torah itself. I would like to perhaps discuss with you some of the ideas that intrigue these young men, and that they wanted me to expound upon. And the one that was most important to them was the idea of the world to come. What is meant? What do we mean when we say does a person cease to exist upon his physical death, or does the soul continue to exist? And if so, what exactly is meant by that? And this was the main topic of discussion that I most of the lectures I gave were dedicated to that topic. In the end, I spent only about an hour or so on halacha, but. As you well understand, these are important areas, and these are areas which are really fundamental to our religion, our understanding of Torah, and yet there aren't too many places where they are dealt with openly. There, throughout the Talmud, there are scattered statements, through some statements of the prophets, but no one really expounds upon it at length, except for some of the early Rishonim, the philosophers. But the one that really does a fantastic job on it is Maimonides, of course. And he felt that it was so important that he put it inside his commentary on the Mishnah, which is really essentially not a philosophical commentary. But he felt that this was so basic and so important that it must be incorporated in his commentary on the Mishnah. So I dedicated most of my time to this segment of Maimonides, which is in the Tractate of Sanhedrin. So it's in the same tractate that we are studying, which has the Sheva Mitzvot, the seven laws. And as a matter of fact, interestingly enough, something that Maimonides says ties in directly to the very next piece of Talmud that we're about to take in our usual course, but I'm going to digress a little bit because I think it's important to discuss some of the ideas of the world to come for Bnei Israel as well as for Bnei Noach. I mean, we should have an understanding of these things. Of course, the question is, or the major question is, what do we mean by an afterlife, and why is an afterlife not mentioned in the five books of Moses? That's an important question, and the concept of an afterlife, what we mean by it, and what verification there is for it. Okay. Actually, Maimonides, as all Jewish scholars do, before he gets to the to the concept of an afterlife itself, he has a lengthy introduction, and he circles around, so to speak, before he gets to the point as to what is exactly meant by an afterlife. I would like to perhaps reverse the order a bit, and we'll come back to his introduction. Just before we get started, I'd like to just make a few statements about what is meant by an afterlife, because I think it's important. I know that if we get started, I don't know if we're going to, if we will get back to it. As a matter of fact, that's what happens in the settlement called Mechmas. That's what happens in Mechmas. I got into Maimonides, and then the last day they started asking, well, what is, Rabbi, well, what do we mean by an afterlife? Went through all the introductions. So I don't want to get started with the introductions and then never get to the point. I'll try to put it briefly and hopefully in an intelligent way that you'll be able to understand what we mean by an afterlife. Just one little introduction, and that is that the concept of an afterlife in Torah is one which demands understanding, as everything in Torah does. There's nothing in Torah that you just can sense. Somehow or other your emotions are going to divine what it means. The primitive religions, of course, are all that way. They could sense immediately what they mean. You know, when they say, well, we believe in this, you're supposed to know exactly what that means. But in Torah, that's not the way it is. The way of Torah is the way of knowledge, and knowledge demands thinking, understanding, and analysis, and therefore it is different. And the same thing is true of the afterlife. Most people, when you talk about an afterlife, they immediately know what you're talking about, and you don't have to explain any further. The mere fact that people know what you're talking about when you don't have to explain it intellectually is a sign that it's an emotional concept. Okay? So there immediately the idea of an afterlife that is commonly referred to is an idea which people emotionally sense, but this is not the idea of an afterlife that the Torah has in mind. The afterlife that the Torah has in mind is something which requires intelligence and knowledge and understanding. Let me just briefly again try to say what in the simplest terms, I'm trying to simplify it as much as I can, as to what exactly we mean by an afterlife and why we maintain that there is an afterlife. Okay, the first thing we have to understand is what we mean by the soul of man. What is the soul of man? So the soul of man, as portrayed in Genesis, is that part which is the divine element of man. The element in man which reflects the Creator, which means that we go beyond the animal perception, and man was given access to a different kind of perception, a different world, so to speak, that he's capable of perceiving, which the animal kingdom is not capable of perceiving. Now, that world is the world of the intellect, the world of knowledge. This is what is meant by the divine element in man. This is something which none of our scholars are in disagreement about. Every one of them agrees that what is meant by the term in Genesis, Tselem Elokim, which means in the divine image, that means that part of man which is the intellect, which is the part of man that perceives knowledge. The word intellect is not precise, is not a really good term, because the word intellect is very restricted. What it means is the knowledge would be a better term, that part of man that deals with knowledge. Now, we maintain that this divine element does not cease to exist after the person's physical death. Okay. Now, why do we say that? Is it just without basis? Well, here again we come into the contradistinction between the afterlife of the primitive man, which is the afterlife of all religions have an afterlife, and that is really based on the fact simply that man does not wish to die. Okay, man does two things. Man does not wish to die; he wishes to live on, and also man is dissatisfied with life. There are many dissatisfactions. Life does not offer a person the enjoyments and the pleasures that he wishes, and therefore what he does is he says, "Well, I don't have it here. I'm going to get it over there." That's the emotional afterlife. That's the common afterlife that that all people, primitive people, man-made religions believe. That's the afterlife that the man-made religions sell. And what they tell people is that if you conform to our religious system, then we guarantee you this wonderful life after you're dead. Okay? And this is a major selling point of religion. Interestingly enough, the Torah did not see fit to use that as a selling point. The Torah makes no mention of it at all. And hopefully we'll get around to why the Torah does not use it that way. Although the Torah definitely maintains that there is such a thing. The fact that the Torah maintains that such a thing is found openly in Ecclesiastes, where it states that the body dies and the soul returns to the Creator. That's the end of at the end of Ecclesiastes. So we do have scripture that states that there is an afterlife. Some people think that there is no scripture like that, but there is. It's pretty open in Ecclesiastes. But let's just for a moment forget about the scriptural support for the idea, and the fact that the oral tradition of the scholars is again without exception that there is an afterlife. But the important thing is to differentiate between the afterlife of primitive people, the afterlife of man-made religions, which is really just more sophisticated primitive idea, and the afterlife that the Torah talks about. The afterlife the Torah talks about is different. It is based upon the concept that man has access, as I said before, to a realm of reality that no other existence has. No other species on this planet has access to. Okay, and that is the realm of knowledge and understanding. Now, let me just go a little further with that. When a person studies, or a person throws a stone, so the stone is going to describe a specific path. And mathematicians can tell you, can describe with formula exactly what that path is, and the type of path that it describes. All right, the planets describe certain paths, but the elliptical the planets have an elliptical path. Now the reason why the planets describe an elliptical path is known to mathematicians and to people who study science. They can explain it and they can show you that there is an idea behind it. But what this shows is that the planet which circles the sun is circling the sun in a physical, through a physical path, a physical orbit. Okay, but the planet itself is a physical object. The reason why it orbits the sun the way it does is based upon a different world, a world of ideas, an abstract world. If you destroy the planet, it will cease to circle the sun. But if you put something else there, that will circle the sun precisely as the planet did. So we see the circling of the sun, which is done by the planet, is not because of a physical cause, doesn't have a physical cause, but rather it is determined by certain ideas in the universe. And this particular mass that finds itself in a certain position will act according to those fixed ideas, and will behave in a very specific way according to the delineation of the ideas that God implanted in the universe. So the physical world responds to a world beyond the physical world, and that is the world of ideas. And everything that we see in the universe can always be attributed to a world of ideas that is the cause of the physical expression that we see. Every scientist that studies the world of nature knows that the world of ideas is something real. that the world of ideas to the person of knowledge is, as a matter of fact, more real than the world of the physical. So here you have the difference between the physical world. You have a specific planet that's circling the sun. That planet undergoes change. The planet could be destroyed, but the ideas that are responsible for its motion and for its movement cannot be destroyed. Those ideas are eternal. And if a specific planet would be destroyed, but you put something else in its place, as I mentioned before, it would follow the exact same path, because the world of ideas is going to determine precisely how it's going to behave. So this is the world that man was given access to. No animal has access to that world. An animal may act logically in a limited way, and an ape may take a stick and knock a banana down from a tree, and he's acting in a logical way, but he could never sit back and contemplate the ideas that are responsible for his ability to knock the banana down from the tree, or why the banana actually falls to the ground. He just acts instinctively. Man can sit back and can recognize that there are ideas behind this, and the banana falling down from the tree reflects a concept. It's not just a specific incident. It's a concept which, as you're probably familiar with, Sir Isaac Newton showed, is the same concept that exists in the entire universe and is responsible for everything, basically, the function of mass in the entire universe. Responsible for the orbiting of planets and the galaxies, and it permeates the entire universe. It's not just a limited kind of phenomenon. So man with his mind goes beyond, can take that one banana that falls down from a tree and can show that this is a general principle. It reflects a reality that permeates the entire universe, is responsible for millions and billions and billions of phenomena, and this idea is the reality, that which is truly real behind the physical, this specific physical phenomena. The specific can change, but this world does not change. This is the world of ideas. This world of ideas does not change, does not decay. It is eternal. Okay? Now, once man recognizes that he has access to an eternal world, a world that is not subject to change, then the next step is to realize that there is something in us that can perceive this world beyond the physical. Now, if we have something in us that can perceive that world, it must partake of that same kind of thing. It must partake of that same kind of substance, so to speak. So that part of us which can perceive the eternal world must also partake of the eternal. And this really is what we mean when we say that there is a part of man that is eternal, that is not subject to destruction. Just like the world of ideas which it perceives is not subject to destruction, so too this part of man which conceives of this world, which can relate to this world, which has access to this world, also is not subject to destruction and continues to exist. And the destruction of the body, which is a physical phenomenon, does not affect the destruction of that part of man, which is tuned into the world of the eternal, which is the world of ideas. And of course, we recognize that the world of ideas goes beyond the physical world, and it goes into the world of Torah as well, because that also is the area of God's eternal ideas. So we have man that has in him something that can tune into this eternal world, and therefore that part of his makeup is not subject to destruction, just like those things that he tunes into. That, I would say, is the most basic premise in understanding what we mean by man's existence after his death. Now, this idea, as it probably has occurred to you, is not as satisfying as the ideas of the man-made religions, okay? Because the man-made religions are trying to sell some kind of personal satisfaction. And this is what Maimonides does. What he does is he starts out with giving the presenting the ideas of the world to come, the afterlife, which are current and prevalent in his time. Were current and prevalent in his time. And he breaks it down to five groups. I'm not going to go into the five groups. I'm just going to take the first group just to give you an illustration. Okay? Now, he says the first group believes that the good is the Garden of Eden. And this is a place where people eat and drink without work. They don't have to toil. And they have their homes of stone, beautiful homes, and rivers which flow with wine and fragrances and all beautiful things that a person can imagine. He says that is, according to them, that is the good. Now he states afterwards, he says, what is evil? What is bad? Bad is Gehenna, Gehinnom. And what is that? That's a place that is burning with fire, where they burn the bodies and torture people with various types of pain. The descriptions of the pains are mentioned in these works. He's just sort of abbreviating. And he says, and this group even brings support from some of the words of the Talmud and from some of the verses of the Tanakh and of Scripture, and that is basically their view. Okay, I'm just going to take the first view, all right? And the first view is an interesting view, and this was something I mentioned when I was in the yeshiva. I said when people look at the first view, they'll say, "Well, that's not me. You know, I don't believe that." I don't believe that the good is a place that's flowing with wine, rivers flowing with wine, and all different kinds of food and beautiful homes. No, I don't believe that. I'm much more advanced than that. But it's interesting. Let's just hold that for a moment. But the second half, they seem to believe. The second half is where there is actual pain, burning fire, hellfires, which when they say hellfires, they have to have in mind some kind of fire. And they usually do think that and do associate the Gehinnom, hell, to some kind of fiery place, which is a very close description to something that we have on this earth. Okay? Now, that half they believe. It's an interesting thing. But since Maimonides, people have changed their views. They've retained one half of that first view, but they've rejected the first half. Okay, the first half, when you talk about, well, what is the good, there, they will not say it's a physical kind of good. But what is the punishment for the wicked, there they will say, well, that is hellfire, physical, some kind of physical pain, all right? Now, I mentioned that people, when a scholar warns someone that what they believe is false, So the point is that when people hear a scholar admonishing them and telling them that what they believe is foolish, there are two reactions, two possible reactions. One reaction is to abandon what you believe and really get into study and knowledge. Okay, that's a very rare reaction. All right? The more common reaction is just to change the accidental features of what you believe so that you can say, hey, he wasn't talking about me. But basically, you'll just find something else, which is a substitute for that, not too far advanced from that, but sort of like a substitute for that same idea that you had before. But now, you can't say the scholar spoke against me. I didn't say that. That's the general reaction. And what's happened here with Maimonides is the same thing. Once Maimonides came out with his works and he admonished a lot of these people for their nonsensical beliefs, they simply changed a few features. And what they did was, they retained the second half about the hellfires, but they got rid of their first half. And they said, well, the good is not really, no, it's not, you don't live in, it's not physical, okay? It's not physical. But, in truth, they really haven't traveled too far from their previous position. First of all, they find themselves in a grave contradiction. Because if you're going going to associate the hell with some kind of physical pain, then it's not logical. Then you're saying that the physical exists after death. So then you should associate the good with physical good. Why do you say no? The good is not physical, it's for the soul. Oh, but then how can punishment be physical? Either you are physical after you die, or you're not. Does your sensory apparatus survive the grave, or don't they survive the grave? If they're there to feel the hellfires, well, why shouldn't they be there to enjoy something good? So you get caught in the kind of contradiction there. But people of that group that I mentioned before, that just try to avoid the admonishment of scholar, they're not really too concerned about contradiction. They're just trying to get out of the way, so to speak. So therefore, you just make a minor change and say, oh, I'm not in that category anymore. But there is a reason psychologically why people do this. And many people believe that way. They believe hell is like a hellfire, but the good they won't say is physical anymore. I mean, they're beyond that. The reason is because, you see, in the world, and especially the Christian world, the pleasure is considered something evil. You see, pleasure is associated with something evil, whereas pain is not. So therefore, it's okay to say that pain exists in the next world, but pleasure is not good, really. So therefore, that can't be in the next world. Must be something else. But usually what they substitute for the good is not too far away from the physical. Okay? And let me give you an example. Billy Graham, for instance, wrote an article on what he's aging now. He realizes he's not going to be here forever. So he wrote, what does he expect in the afterlife? So he wrote, he expects Jesus to pat him on the back and tell him he did a great job. Okay, now, that idea is really no more advanced. It is just as primitive, really, as saying that, the afterlife is a place where there are beautiful homes and rivers are flowing with wine. Because it's an enjoyment of the ego, all right? Now, there's not too much difference between an enjoyment of the ego and an enjoyment of the body. I mean, both things are really physical phenomena. And that one is a little more, one is psychological, so say it's a little more removed, but basically the psychological enjoyments that we have are really nothing more than the sublimated instinctual. So they're a little higher, but they basically are tied to the instinctual, and that fantasy of enjoying a pat on the back throughout eternity is really just as childish as enjoying a river flowing with wine. So man today hasn't really come too far away from the example Maimonides gave, although in order to avoid the wrath of the scholars, they've changed it from physical pleasures to psychological pleasures. Okay? They'll be with their families, with their loved ones, which again is psychological pleasures. So they went from the physical to the psychological. But that's where they've remained. Okay. Now, this is very different, seriously different than the idea that I mentioned before, that the part of the soul that exists throughout eternity is only that part that has contact with the world of ideas. The world of ideas of Torah, ideas of God's universe, ideas of knowledge that God has enabled us to have access to. That's a different, qualitatively different kind of concept. That concept is one which you will not find in the man-made religions because it's not something that the instincts strive for. Okay, it's not an instinctual gratification kind of thing. And the man-made religions and the primitive people, what they're trying to do is to satisfy the instinctual and to grant man all his instinctual requests, which he hasn't been able to attain in this world, and also to grant him the fact that he will not cease to exist, die, which is a frightening thing for man. goes like this. He says, just like the blind man has no concept whatsoever of color, and the deaf person has no concept of sound, he says, so too, those human being, while he is alive in this form, in the form that we are in, during our lifetime, has no concept whatsoever of the pleasure of the soul, the true pleasure of the soul. That's something which exists only after death. It does not exist in this life. Okay, and he quotes the words of the prophet, where the prophet says the world to come, the eye has not seen it, only you, God, have seen it. So it's something which man, we, have no experience of. Here again, Torah diverges completely away from the man-made religions, which claim that they have spiritual enjoyments in this world. And we say that that is not so. This may sound shocking and strike a person as being incorrect, but let me elaborate a little more on it so that I'll give you a better idea of what he means. What Maimonides is saying here is a very deep concept, and it's a true one if a person has knowledge of psychology, and that is that all the gratifications that we get in this world, all the satisfactions that we have in this world, are purely of a psychological nature, okay? Because the soul in this world is joined to the body. And in that union between the soul and the body, the only thing that we have of the soul is its function. The soul functions, okay? But the pleasure that we receive, even when the soul functions, is purely from the psyche, which is from the physical aspect of man's nature. All right? In other words, if we discuss Torah, we get together and we learn Torah. And learning Torah is, according to Torah, and according to anyone who has experienced it, is really, truly the greatest enjoyment in life. The greatest enjoyment. It's a pure enjoyment, and if you get into the ideas, you experience a tremendous elation. And you have a very sublime kind of enjoyment, an enjoyable experience in study and in knowledge. And knowledge gives man a very satisfying kind of activity. It's a very satisfying activity. It makes a person happy. Gives a person happiness. It's easily accessible. He can always be involved in it, and it's always there to give him satisfaction and pleasure. But this satisfaction and pleasure, which gives man really, according to Torah, the greatest life, not the physical pleasures, it's not the physical pleasure that gives man the greatest life. Physical pleasures, on the contrary, are really frustrating. But the pleasure of learning is one which has no frustration and is pure pleasure. And people who are who can indulge in this in this type of thing, even in the secular world, speak about how enjoyable it is, and they will choose that enjoyment over other enjoyments. I remember watching recently a scientist that had a show on great physicists, and they were talking about Albert Einstein and various other physicists. And this fellow was a scientist himself. He says, "Well, he says when I want to enjoy myself and I start thinking about a problem in physics." He says, just like, for you, I guess it would be like going to a movie, he said, but for my entertainment, I think about a problem of physics. So the enjoyment of reason, the enjoyment of the mind is something which is experienced by man, and even secular man recognizes that this is a great experience, and those who have access to it will prefer it over other involvements. Nevertheless, what Maimonides says is, even a person studying Torah, gaining the sublime enjoyment from the Torah itself, his enjoyment is not a spiritual enjoyment. It still is a psychological enjoyment. Because the soul is united with the body in this existence. And the pleasure that we experience is always of a physical nature. Okay? It's of a psychological nature. When I say physical, I mean psychological. psychological. Psychological is also physical. So Maimonides makes it clear that in this earthly existence, even the enjoyments of knowledge in Torah are basically rooted in the our psychological makeup, the psychological pleasures. But there is so what do we have in this existence of the eternal? It's not the pleasure that we have here, he states. It is simply the function. The fact, the function, the soul does function in our existence. When we think, it is the soul that is functioning. The brain is only a tool for the soul. The brain is like the computer. But the soul, the ideas, the source of the ideas, behind the mechanism of the brain, is really the soul. Mm-hmm. That is the function of that. That is that element that God gave man that gives him access to that other world, where things are indestructible and eternal. So that function we have in this world.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right. In light of what you're saying now, do you make a distinction between the Nefesh, the Ruah, and Neshama, or are you grouping them all as one for the purpose of this study?
For this, I am grouping them as one. Those terms have a different meaning. The term, and in different places also.
Okay.
I mean,
right.
You know, there are three different terms, and I will get into that another time, but that's
okay.
Really not what I'm doing
all right.
Right now.
All right. Okay? That's good.
So here we see the concept. The concept of the Torah concept of the afterlife completely diametrically opposed to the concept, the general idea of what people mean when they think of an afterlife. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to try. I realize the time is short. I'm going to try to just bring in one more point, which I think is extremely helpful. With regard to this to the subject matter, and that is, in Maimonides, now I'm going to flip back to his introduction. Okay, now in his introduction, he states as follows. He discusses the difficulty. He discusses how the masses of people really have no concept of what is meant by the world to come, and he states as follows. He says that one of the difficulties that a person has in understanding what is meant by the existence of the soul, and what do we mean by a person living in this world a life in line with his soul, he says, is the fact that man always feels he has to do something for a purpose. Okay. And that is a common psychological phenomenon. And what Maimonides tries to do is he tries to strip through the psychological barriers that prevent the person from really seeing the true notion, the true concept, true idea of the afterlife. And he says that one of the problems that one of the obstacles that exists. And the stand in the way of man's knowledge of the afterlife is a fact, is a certain psychological phenomenon. And that psychological phenomenon is that a person always tries to do something for some other purpose. Okay? Now, I'm going to explain to you what he means by that, because if you just read him, when Maimonides writes, it's sometimes difficult to pick up what he's getting at. What he means to say is that there is an instinctual part of man that, strangely enough, always causes him to do things for something else. What is that something else? The truth of the matter is, he never gets there. That's the truth of the matter. But he's always doing something for something else. Okay? So you'll tell me, well, what do you mean? Well, okay, a man goes to work. Why? In order to earn money. Everybody says, yes, you do it, you're working for something else. Correct. But then somebody will say, yeah, but once I get the money, now I'm going to enjoy myself. And that's just plain for enjoyment and pleasure. Okay? Sounds nice, but it's not that simple. Man always himself as easy as he thinks it sounds, it is really very difficult. But most of a person's life is always for a goal. Man is goal-oriented. I'm talking about the normal man is goal-oriented. And he always has to have a goal. He's never really quite satisfied. And that goal is something which gives him a sense of worth, of direction, of purpose in life. Everybody's like, what purpose in life? Well, what if another person say, well, I have no purpose in life. I'm just enjoying life. Well, you'd look at him in askance. You'd say, I wouldn't believe him, and you'd feel sorry for him. He has no purpose in life. Okay? So man, by nature, is drawn to purpose. Okay? As a matter of fact, I should have a show. I'll get back to it next week. But it's one of the ideas that's mentioned right on this very page that we will continue with about the Sheva Mitzvot, and it's from the prophets. That's one of the selling points of idolatry. One of the selling points of idolatry is that man needs a purpose. And idolatry always supplies him with a purpose. That's why idolatry imposes restrictions. You'd think, hey, who wants to join a group that has restrictions? No, because those restrictions make him feel that he has a purpose. So man is drawn towards restrictions and pain just as much as he's drawn towards pleasure. He only fools himself in thinking that he's drawn towards pleasure. He really can't do it. And you'll see people that retire, they find the first month is great. But then in short order, they discover that it's not so great. And there's an emptiness getting up every morning, not knowing what to do. I'm sure you've met people like that, and so have I. That some people say, well, golf saved my life. You know why? Because in golf there's a goal to beat the next opponent, to improve my game, to do some kind of a goal. You see, some kind of a goal. Man thinks he could have pleasure, but it's not that simple. He's always looking for a goal. So Maimonides explains that is one of the primary difficulties in a person understanding what the world to come is, okay? Because a person in an afterlife is always looking for something in place of what he is doing, all right? And that's why whatever he's doing here, it's like Mark Twain said, that people want to do it, think that they're going to do in heaven what they get bored of doing over here in a few hours on Sunday. Which means to say that they're in contradiction. They won't admit that they're looking for something which is really instead of that, which is really in place of that, some superior kind of enjoyment. What they're doing is sort of like paying off God, like I'll do all this, you know, this rough stuff, so you'll give me something better when I get there. Okay? So Maimonides says that's the thing that stands in the way of a person recognizing what the true concept, the true idea of an afterlife is. Because he says it is difficult for man to do the good for the sake of the good and to recognize that this is the good. In other words, a goalless existence. Alright? Now, the good really, in the eyes of Torah, is Torah itself. The study of Torah, the learning of Torah, knowledge. This is the good. So when a man is involved in the study of Torah, he shouldn't be looking for any other good. This is it. He's here. He's arrived. But as Maimonides points out, it's very difficult for a person to accept that and to say, this is it? I'm here? He's looking for a goal-oriented type of existence. And that's what stands in the way of his perception of what the afterlife is. He's looking for something else in place of what he's got when what he's got is really what it is. In other words, when a person involves himself in the study of Torah, when he involves himself in the world of God's ideas, that is it. He's there. The only thing that exists in the afterlife that is different is that it's an augmentation of that exact same process. Okay? In other words, it's an expansion of the process. There are two things that change. One thing is that man has a greater ability to perceive ideas when the soul is free from the limitations which the body necessarily impose upon him. Because in this world, all our knowledge must come through the senses, and that is intrinsically a limitation. That limitation is gone. So his ability to perceive knowledge is increased. That's one. And two, there is an attending satisfaction which the good in this world, that is it. That is the good. He must recognize that the study, the knowledge, the involvement in Torah, this is really, he is there. He has arrived. That is the good. That is something which is extremely difficult for man to accept, because he always wants a payment for something, to be repaid for something in place of what he's doing. And that's why he has a total misconception of what is meant by an afterlife. This, I believe, is one of the is one of the most salient points that Maimonides mentions in his introduction, where he goes through those things which are barriers and prevent the person from understanding what the afterlife is. Now, he mentions something also very interesting over here, in line with this. He says that there was an incident that the Talmud records that a great scholar by the name of Antigonus, who was giving a lecture, and he stated, "Do not be like servants who serve the master in order to receive reward, but be as servants who serve the master not to receive reward." Okay? So the Talmud states that from that lecture, two students walked away, and they were the founders of the Sadducees. One was a Tzadok. I don't know what transliteration is, but the Sadducees come from that, from him. He was the head of the Sadducees, and the other was Bisos, the Bisusim, David probably knows. I'm sure David knows the word for that. They resulted from his teaching. So what they said was that they walked away from that lecture misinterpreting the lecture, and they thought that what was meant was that there is no reward. Okay? There is no such thing as a reward, period. So they left the lecture, and they were depressed about it, and they accepted it as correct that there is no afterlife. And then they started these two groups, okay, which became the Sadducees and then the Bisusis. Now, the rabbis admonished Antigonus, and they reprimanded him because they said to him, they quoted a statement, the famous quote, which is, "Chacham, wise men, be careful with what you say." All right? And they reprimanded him. They said he was wrong because he should never have said that in public. Okay? Which means to say, you see, the scholars recognize the fact that there are certain things, that certain ideas that could be shared among scholars and not among the laity until the laity advances and becomes scholars. But certain things you cannot share with laymen, because they will not understand, they will misunderstand it, and they can cause themselves great harm, just like a physician might not tell a patient exactly how certain things work, because he's afraid the patient will take things into their own hands and will harm themselves. The same thing is true in Torah. So the rabbis reprimanded Antigonus for making that statement. Maimonides mentions this, but there is a very strange thing here going on here, and that is that if it really was wrong for Antigonus to make that statement, so now the question is, so why did the rabbis record it? As a matter of fact, Antigonus' statement is recorded in the Ethics of the Fathers, just exactly as I said it before. Do not be a servant that serves the master in order to receive reward. Now, if that statement was such a dangerous statement and was so potent that it led
to... Rabbi, we got one minute.
All right.
Rabbi, we got 1 minute.
Okay. I'll just have to stop.
Less than 1 minute now.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll just have to stop with the question. I'll let you think about it. If there is somewhat of a contradiction here, and that is that if that was really such a terrible statement, how come the rabbis recorded the statement openly, and it's mentioned in the name of Antigonus in the Ethics of the Fathers in the first chapter? If actually that was a dangerous statement, why did they repeat the situation by recording the statement? Okay? And the answer to that question is an interesting one, and it gives more insight, further insight into what is meant by the afterlife. We'll get back to it next week. Okay, thank you.